In the late spring of 1490, Dominican friars stood at the gates of Florence. It wasn't the first time that the 38-year-old Girolamo Savonarola had made the 100-mile trip from his native Ferrara to the city. He'd lived in Florence for a short time before. The Florentines admired his scholarship, but they were put off by the vehemence of his preaching and the high-sounding speechifying that he was used to as someone more accustomed to theological debates with fellow friars and priests than conversations with the man on the street. But now he returned at the invitation of Lorenzo de' Medici, known even in his own time as the Magnificent. Lorenzo virtually owned Florence and had been encouraged by the famous philosopher Mirandola to invite the fiery Dominican to return. While in Florence that first time, Savonarola's studies convinced him that the church was in desperate need of reform, especially its priesthood. His time in convents and monasteries had convinced him that the church was more interested in politics and acquiring wealth and power than in making disciples of Jesus. When his welcome ran out in Florence, Savonarola embarked on an itinerant preaching campaign around northern Italy. With more experience in public discourse, his style improved and came alongside his already keen intellect. He moved from being a coarse agitator into a powerful convincer. And it was then that Mirandola had heard him and was impressed by his preaching. So when the philosopher ran afoul of church authorities for some of his unorthodox beliefs, Lorenzo offered him sanctuary. Finding Savonarola a kindred spirit in his contest with the church, Mirandola wanted Savonarola at his side as a spiritual counselor. And so he convinced his patron Lorenzo that Savonarola, now a well-known figure in the region, would bring prestige to the San Marco church and convent there in Florence. And if you know anything about the Medicis, prestige was a chief ambition. So the invitation was sent and Savonarola arrived. He went first to the monastery of St. Mark and began a series of lectures for his fellow friars. And soon others joined the sessions, causing them to have to relocate to the main hall. The lectures turned into sermons. And by the Lenten season of 1491, Savonarola's growing fame saw him invited to preach at the main church in Florence. Always short on tax, Savonarola lambasted the decadence of the city's rich, of which there were not a few. Lorenzo de' Medici was especially displeased. I mean, who did this upstart think that he was? He'd only come to Florence at Lorenzo's invitation. This was no way for a guest in his city to act. So Lorenzo hired another preacher to attack Savonarola. The plan failed since the people sided with Savonarola. He'd become their champion in decrying the exorbitant luxuries of the wealthy. And didn't this tactic by Lorenzo only prove the very thing that Savonarola was pointing out? That the priesthood was corrupt? For goodness sake, a priest had been hired by a rich man to do his bidding? Still, the mercenary preacher refused to accept defeat. He plotted his revenge by going to Rome and working to undermine Savonarola at a higher level. As Savonarola's fame spread among the Florentines, he was elected prior of St. Mark's. Now, he wasn't just preaching sermons calling for reform, he was in a position to do something about them. And do he did. Within a short time, he reformed the life of the community so thoroughly that the people of Florence all remarked on how holy the order had grown. Savonarola believed that study belonged at the very heart of monastic reform. And so the friars at St. Mark studied Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic, all so that they could read the classic sources of theology and not have to depend on inferior translations by authors who often did more interpretation and commentary than they did translation. Savonarola sold off some of the monastery's estates and gave the proceeds to the poor. His reputation was unimpeachable. No attempt to assail his character or integrity found any purchase, but not for lack of trying. Several brought accusations by those that hoped to ingratiate themselves with the Medicis. Though bitter enemies, when Lorenzo lay dying, he asked for the prior to come bless him. I think it says much about Savonarola's personal commitment to integrity that his chief enemy wanted him at his bedside to offer last rites. Lorenzo had much to worry about in his journey to the afterlife. He knew that his soul was in dire straits, and apparently he hoped that Savonarola's moral purity and spiritual weight would help his cause with God. But of course, if Savonarola was indeed so right, why had Lorenzo opposed him before? This last act only served to add to the grievousness of his earlier heir. Lorenzo's successor was Pietro de' Medici. Simply put, he was not Lorenzo. Pietro promptly lost all respect from the Florentines. We'll come back to that in a bit. What gained Savonarola the most attention was his role as a seeming prophet. His preaching on the Book of Revelation drew huge crowds. He made allusions between Revelation's visions of future judgment to his own day and both the political and religious situation in Europe. Avoiding names, he still managed to call out tyrants and the cozy system that they had constructed that was taking advantage of the poor. He excoriated corrupt prelates and priests, boldly calling them to repent lest God's judgment fall on them. This was something new, moving the Book of Revelation's forecast of what till then had been regarded as far-off distant future judgments close to that time, to that day. While scoffers dismissed Savonarola as just a hothead whose popularity caused him to lose a sense of propriety, his supporters only became more convinced that he was a prophet. He certainly sounded like one. In 1492, the same year that Cristoforo Colombo ran into the West Indies and began the opening of the New World to the Old, Savonarola warned of a sword of the Lord over the earth quickly and soon. He spoke of great travails about to descend on a corrupt Roman papacy. A year later, in a nod to the Persian Emperor Cyrus the Great, who had allowed the Jews to return to rebuild Jerusalem, Savonarola foretold a new Cyrus who would come from across the mountains bringing renewal to the church. And sure enough, a year after that, Francis King Charles VIII crossed the Alps with a formidable army and invaded Italy. Savonarola was confirmed in the minds of many as a genuine prophet. Now, instead of organizing the defense of Florence as he ought to have, Pietro de' Medici attempted to buy Charles off, and when the Florentines heard of it, they were furious and sent their own embassy under Savonarola to the French. Savonarola pressed Charles to spare Florence and accept his calling as a reformer of the church. Though the French did occupy Florence for a couple of weeks, they were eventually persuaded to move on. Savonarola attributed this seemingly miraculous deliverance to the Florentines' remarkable response to his call for repentance. He said that Florence was a new ark into which the elect would find refuge from the rising tide of God's judgment soon to overtake the world. The city, he said, was poised to become rich and powerful both temporally and spiritually. When the loathed Pietro was ousted from office and the Florentines seemed to have not just saved but heavily favored under Savonarola's leadership, he moved into the role of civil leader by default. He set about to design a new government that was free of the meddling and manipulation of the nobility. He recommended a republic and installed reforms to heal the ailing economy. He gathered a good part of the gold and silver of the many city churches and used it to feed the poor. This was the high water mark of Savonarola's life and work. He began a preacher of reform, and then he was handed the opportunity to install it, not only in the church, but in the civil sphere as well. Now, being of the mind that poverty was holy, he railed against the luxuries of the wealthy, placing them all under the rubric of vanity. Such vanities, he loudly announced, were a distraction that weakened the soul and made it prone to sin. So at his urging, the people of Florence regularly would gather up such vanities into a pile and then set them ablaze. They would first lay out straw and kindling that was sprinkled with some gunpowder. On that, they would lay larger kindling, and then on top of that were placed the vanities that the Florentines had been convinced by Savonarola's preaching were weighing them down and tying them to earth. Frilly dresses, jewelry, wigs, ostentatious furniture, anything that wasn't plain and utilitarian. Then, amidst joyous singing and ceremony, the heap was set on fire, a bonfire of the vanities. These bonfires replaced the traditional carnival just before Lent, another vanity that Savonarola called out. Soon, Florence saw bands of enthusiastic reform enforcers roaming the streets to ensure rules of modesty were kept. His reforms were duplicated in the surrounding cities. He was invited to bring them there. The popular view of history regards Savonarola as a dangerous fanatic and ignorant monk. He most certainly was neither. He was simply one who understood that the church and the Italian society had gone far from the biblical ideal. As so many other proto-reformers in the two centuries before the Reformation, Savonarola simply wanted to get back to the apostolic ideal described in the New Testament. He espoused some of the core theological points later reformers like Luther and Calvin would develop. Some have gone so far as to call Savonarola a proto-Protestant. What he was, and what got him in trouble and eventually led to his fall, was that he was an anti-politician. He had little capacity for compromise, which is doomed for anyone engaged in civil politics. There was no nuance in Savonarola. He was all black or white, no gray. He was unable to distinguish between rules and principles, between non-negotiables and his own opinions. And that set him on a collision course with the very people who had put him in power. Savonarola's downfall came about because of his inability to play the political game. Alexander VI, one of the worst of the popes, made an alliance against Florence that included a good part of Italy, Germany, and Spain. The smart move was to join the pope's party, but Savonarola insisted on keeping his promise to the French. The pope responded with severe economic measures against Savonarola personally, and then against all of Florence. When the Florentines realized that they'd lost a great deal of their trade because their pastor was being stubborn, opposition toward him began to grow. A sure way to sway political will is to hit people in their pocketbooks. Florence became increasingly fractured between supporters and opponents. On the opponents' side were most of the wealthy, but Savonarola's supporters declared him a prophet. They were convinced that his enemies would be persuaded to back him if he would just perform a miracle or two. Their convictions turned to a demand that he do just that, perform a miracle. And when he failed to deliver, they turned on him. A mob marched on St. Mark's to apprehend him. Savonarola refused to defend himself. He forbade friends from resisting the mob lest an innocent be harmed. So he was hauled to the city square where he was beaten and turned over to the authorities, some who had longed for this day for years. Well, this was it, the civil showdown. The authorities had to find something damning to accuse him of. So to elicit a confession, he was tortured for days. The most that they could make him confess was to something he'd never claimed, that he was a prophet. It was others that had called him that. Well, the Pope even sent legates to assist in the trial. They also tortured Savonarola, but all they could obtain was an admission that he'd planned to appeal to a church council to solve these problems. Savonarola admitted that he'd been too proud, maybe, in his call for reform. That's hardly worth a death sentence. So despairing of finding charges severe enough to execute him, the judges condemned Savonarola and two friends of being heretics and schismatics, without ever identifying precisely what heresy they had espoused. So they were turned over to the civil authorities to be executed. The only mercy that Savonarola received was that he and his friends were hanged before they were burnt. Their ashes were then thrown into the Arno River. This was considered the height of infamy. By scattering one's ashes, there was nothing left of them to remember, no place for people to mark a memorial and keep their name alive. In spite of this, there were many of Savonarola's supporters who kept his relics. Now, I've been to Florence, and I've stood at the little memorial on the paving stones of the main piazza, marking the place that he was executed. Years after his death, when Rome was sacked by the Germans, some saw it as the fulfillment of Savonarola's prophecy. To this day, there are those in the Roman Church who argue that Savonarola was a saint and that his name should be added to the official list. For me, Savonarola is a classic example of a zealot, someone wholly convinced that he was on God's side and doing his work. So much so, he deemed himself above correction. When it served the interests of the powers that be to use him, they did. But when his barbs came their way, they turned against him. For a time, it looked like the civil apparatus of Florence would be the vehicle of Savonarola's reforms. Now keep in mind that the Europe of those days made no real distinction between church and state. They were more often than not joined at the hip, but the union was always an uneasy one. Civil officials have always understood the political game better than the clergy. They will use whatever's available to gain and retain power, including people of faith. But they will never, ever let go of that power. It's theirs, and they guard it jealously. Politicians make common cause with whoever will advance their goal of staying in charge. in Florence for a season, it was Savonarola. They let him take the public face of power for a time when it served their purpose, and when it no longer did, they killed him. Nothing's changed. The wielders of the levers of political power are more than happy to ally themselves with the religious left, middle, or right, if it means more votes. But as soon as that alliance is no longer profitable, watch out. Here come the torches.